It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. When we feel unstable or adrift in our daily lives, we may seek out people, places, or activities to help us feel more grounded.
But we could consider the ground itself as a source of steadying comfort.
The rocks, the sand, the sediment, whether we're aware of it or not, have their own stories of highs, lows, change, and resilience through the millennia.
Our next guest has been studying rocks and learning from them since her childhood in rural northwestern Wisconsin. Marcia Bjornerud is the Walter Schober Professor of Environmental Studies and Professor of Geosciences at Lawrence University in Appleton. Her new book is called Turning to Stone, Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks. Marcia, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks, Kate. So happy to join you.
In your research field, you write about how it's considered sinful to see rocks and mountains and glaciers as anything other than inert objects, and yet you describe them with words like creative and alert and communicative. How are rocks alive to you?
Well, you're right. It is a bit of a taboo in science to consider entities in nature in any sense animate or sentient, but as a structural geologist, someone who studies mountain building, I understand that rocks really are moving. They're moving across the globe tectonically. They're wrinkling and deforming as continents collide. And so in a very literal sense, rocks are animate. But I would also say that our perception that rocks and landscapes more broadly, or the earth as a whole, are inert entities is a real delusion, a misconception. The earth is noticing what is happening, what we're doing to it. Rocks that formed billions of years ago are drinking in yesterday's rainwater. Everything is in communication in real time. And I think developing this sense of the natural world as, in some sense, sentient is really essential for us both environmentally and, I would argue, psychologically.
When you see rocks as having distinct personalities, does something inside you change? What makes that special when you give them these human qualities?
Well, I think having a sense of familiarity, even kinship with entities in nature, not only living things, but the very rocky substrates below us, can give one a real sense of groundedness, of belonging to this very ancient, amazing earth ecosystem. And for me, there's a real joy in being able to see a rock, recognize it by name, give it a greeting, and read what it's saying. I often use metaphors of rocks as texts. And to me, that's very much the way I feel about rocks when I see them in the wild. They're fragments of some grander, larger manuscript, but I can't help but try to read them.
As you help us understand rocks, we also get glimpses of your own story, your own life, as part of this book. Can you take us back to your childhood as a kid in the 70s in rural Wisconsin, where the sand and the sandstone were part of your origin story?
Yes, and I'm sure many listeners from Wisconsin will recognize their own childhoods. I grew up in a rural part of northwestern Wisconsin where the bedrock is sand. And it's only really in retrospect that I recognize how powerful the bedrock was in shaping the economy and the culture of the place. It's the aquifer. It dictates the soil types and what trees will grow on the land. So I use my own small human story in the book as a kind of portal, inviting people into how one develops a deepening sense of being an earthling.
It astounds me how you could walk along Lake Superior or a rock formation in some of the most remote places of the earth that we'll talk about. You know what you're seeing. How do you retain all this knowledge to identify rocks and minerals and fossils and landforms and faults?
It takes time. And I know many people feel somewhat frustrated at learning to identify rocks and minerals and learning to think geologically. And having taught geology now at the college level for more than 30 years, I realized that geology is really a way of seeing more than anything. It's the capacity to envision landscapes evolving through time. So really seeing in four dimensions, and learning rock and mineral names and knowing how to identify these things is just the start. It's like learning the basic vocabulary of a language, but to really then be able to think geologically requires kind of a sense of the grammar and even the history of a place. And it's a cognitively challenging thing. Everyone can do it, but it does take some practice.
Marcia, take us to your Arctic field seasons, to the Arctic Ocean with these really harsh conditions. And you just find such beauty, but also such amazing possibilities of what we don't know about Earth. What was that like for you?
I was very fortunate as a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin to spend several field seasons in Svalbard, which is an archipelago about 400 miles north of the Norwegian mainland, about halfway between Norway and the North Pole. And when I started there, it really was a very remote place. It's become a bit more accessible these days to cruise ships and tourism. But before GPS and before cell phones, we would be dropped off by a Norwegian Polar Institute ship and left for 2 months to be pretty much on our own. We would have occasional replenishment of food by helicopter. But
if they were in the area, like you may not get that fresh food. I mean, just it was like by happenstance from what I understand.
Exactly. If they happened to be flying by for some other reason, they might drop off some bread or vegetables for us. So that experience was very formative for me. I feel very fortunate, as I say, to have experienced such isolation and a place where nature loomed so large. There was absolutely no delusion that we were more powerful. We just had to respect the weather and the polar bears and the rocky slopes and adjust ourselves accordingly.
And you're tasked with trying to describe the story of mountains. What is fascinating about mountain building?
Well, the idea, again, that rocks can change shape, that they are shapeshifters, they are malleable, they're flowing in some sense, I think gripped me early on as a geology student, that we could see this record of mountains growing if we just learned how to read the clues that were preserved in mountains. And in fact, Wisconsin is a very good place to do this. People may not realize that we have a fantastically geodiverse state. And in the northern third or so of the state in particular, we have records of several distinct tectonic events, and including at least two great mountain ranges and volcanoes and even quite large earthquakes in the past. So I think that sense of animacy is what drew me to the field of structural geology and tectonics.
But your research also was drawing you to basically the ends of the earth, nothing that was very close in proximity to where you were. Was that difficult for you to be able to do studies in the Arctic and to really hone in on your field research that was so far from life?
It was challenging, but again, it was a privilege to go to these places. I also worked a bit with the Geological Survey of Canada in Ellesmere Island, which is the northern coast of it, is as far as you can go and still be on land, as far as you can go to the north and still be on land. But there is some virtue in places like that. There's very little vegetation obscuring the rocks. I do like trees and grasslands, but they obscure the bedrock beneath. So in these very elemental places, in some ways, it's easier to do geology because it's just such a naked elemental landscape.
And Can we turn to your story at Lawrence University and your professional career and your personal life really starts to become so stressful to unravel. You're trying to move an entire geology department's inventory as a building is leveled and your family is just going through a crisis. Can you talk about that time of your life?
It was a hard time. I'm very happy now to be at Lawrence, but when I had moved from a tenured position at Miami of Ohio, I wanted to be closer to family here in Wisconsin, and I wanted my children to grow up with snowy winters. So I relocated the family back to Wisconsin. And soon after that, coming to Lawrence, the building we occupied, the geology department occupied, was scheduled to be torn down and a new one was to be built. But I was charged with relocating everything that had accumulated in the department for more than 100 years. And as you can imagine, that involved a lot of rocks and equipment. So there was that. At the same time, my husband at the time was diagnosed with leukemia and eventually passed away. And so I had him to care for, as well as three small boys at the time. So the convergence of those things was a challenge. But we came through, we moved the department, a new building was built, and we are a very strong community now.
When you bring your students out into the field, it brings out the best in you. You would say it brings out the best in your students as well, and you take them to the Baraboo Quartzite. Can you talk about those field expeditions and what they're learning?
Yes, teaching in the field is really the optimal way to get people thinking geologically, because they're learning through their feet and their ears and their noses. They're interacting with people in a way that is often much less self-conscious than if they were sitting in a classroom setting, because again, the natural world is the milieu that everyone is immersed in. And so I even in our introductory courses, we make sure that students are getting rich and diverse field experiences. As I mentioned before, Wisconsin is a really geodiverse state. Although we don't have a place like the Grand Canyon where we can see all of the rocks of all the ages that we have, if you go from north to south and east to west, we have a wider range of rock types and ages of rocks than the Grand Canyon. And so this is a wonderful place to teach geology. Here in the eastern part of the state, here in Appleton, we're very close to the Niagara Escarpment. We've got glacial deposits. We don't have to go too far to the north to be in much older Precambrian rocks. So there are many chapters in Wisconsin's history that are available to us if we just know where to look.
Do you have a favorite lesson or a favorite place when you take the students there?
I do. There is this beautiful outcrop that geologists call Point of Rocks. It's right on or off now Highway 12 north of Sauk City. And for many years, it was quite a dangerous place because it's the one place in the road there between Baraboo and Sauk that there was a very sharp bend. The road bent around this promontory of rocks. And about 15 or so years ago, the U.S. Department of Transportation actually had plans to blast that outcrop away, straighten the highway, and make it safer. But geologists from around the country, led by Bob Dott, who was a much beloved member of the faculty at UW-Madison in the geology department, rallied and argued that that was really a natural heritage site and must be preserved. And after several years of negotiations and quite a lot of investment, the highway was rerouted on an overpass, and this beautiful Point of Rocks outcrop is now preserved below the highway and is actually a much better place to take students because trucks are not rushing past constantly. And it's been preserved as a natural heritage site, and it's accessible to anyone who would like to visit.
Marcia, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Kate. Thank you.
Marcia Bjornerud is a professor of environmental studies and geosciences at Lawrence University in Appleton. Her book is called Turning to Stone, Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks.